Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a business marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of B2B marketing professionals and people interested in B2B marketing. It's run by B2B marketers for B2B marketers. We provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, training, podcasts, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for B2B marketers. And today, we have over 1,000 participants across the world. If this is the first time you've joined us, you're very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. If you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's good to have you along again. In this episode, I'll be speaking to Rebecca Highfield, Marketing Manager at Action Rocket, about authenticity in branding, plus consultant Uri Baruchin on strategy in crisis. Lior Frank shares a key lesson that he's taken on the journey to being CMO of Augusta Ventures, and Lisa Daniels, the head of marketing at BT Enterprise, celebrates great business marketing. Ready? Well, let's cut to the chase. Business branding itself has a bad brand. It's said to lack independent inspiration. There's no need for emotion because the focus is on getting to the RFP or the tender. Instead, it's a tick box exercise that encourages businesses not to differentiate. But is that view fair? I'm joined by marketing manager at Action Rocket, Rebecca Highfield. Rebecca, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave. Thank you for having me today.
Good to have you here. So what's gone wrong with business branding?
I think that a lot of marketers have just got into such a habit of speaking professionally that they often just lose the human touch. Their messaging becomes boring. It's really important for B2B brands to remember that they're human too. So by showing their authenticity and what's really behind their shiny logos and the sales messaging, that they can really stand out to their customers and subscribers.
So why is this kind of robotic inhumanity kind of come about?
I think it's so easy for marketers and brands to get carried away with the business goals and the KPIs that they forget that they're actually talking to real people. There's humans at the end of that email. So remembering to show them that you recognize them as individuals can go a really long way. And reminding them why they signed up to their brand, why are they interested in you, using key data insights and really returning the value. Consider what you can offer them. What do you have to give to them? If you don't have a clear answer to this, then maybe it's time to reevaluate your marketing communication, because there's no point in sending out emails for the sake of it. There should always be a clear message behind each email and a clear action that you want the subscribers to take.
So if businesses follow that through and so fix what's gone wrong with business branding, what sort of results can they expect?
Ultimately, valuable relationships. The probability of selling to an existing customer is 60 to 70%, whilst the probability of selling to a new prospect is only 5 to 20. So earning a new customer can be expensive, and putting the greater focus on customer retention can be a much better way to drive purchases. Increasing the relationships with the existing subscribers will also ensure that your brand is front of mind. They'll remember you, they'll be further engaged, and ultimately, loyal customers are always likely to spend more.
And so that all sounds very good on paper. Can you share some examples then of businesses that do this well?
Yeah, definitely. So it's all about the added value. A brand that do this really well are Moo. So we use Moo to print all of our business cards at Action Rocket. And their emails are always full of really engaging and relevant content, often following up with key annual dates and reasons to order from them. So they understand when businesses might need their products. For example, I think I received an email recently from them, which was how to attract people to your business stand, but it was related to COVID and working from home and different ways of working. So as a consumer from their brand, I can relate to the content that they're sending me. And their messaging is never too salesy. So they do push their products, but in a nice, subtle way. They focus on the potential value that their premium designs can offer customers. So if your last order was their basic business card range, then they'll subtly follow up and ask how it was, and if you want their new rounded corner business cards, for instance, or something a little bit more premium. And they send their subscribers, they also work on internal content, so they create their own blog articles. Right. So that's quite nice. It's they're giving you extra value in the inbox. They're not just sending you things because they want you to buy it. You're also getting something from that communication.
So their passion kind of really comes.
Yeah, definitely. You can see they're interested in your industry and giving you, yeah, just extra added value, really. Another brand who do this really well are Really Good Emails. They're an online collective of email marketing's best bits, showcasing the industry's most exciting and innovative work. So showing off innovative work constantly, you would expect them to also have an innovative newsletter that they send out. So luckily they do. They often use dynamic imagery in their newsletters, which is great. And it's a really nice personal touch. I'm always excited to see what the hero is going to include in their email newsletters. I think my favorite was on recently an International Goth Day, which you might think would be really...
No, there was an International
Exactly,
Goth.
I know. And that could be really difficult to make it relatable to their audience. And why would I be interested in that? But they heroed it at the top of their newsletter and it was dynamic. And so there was a band in it. And I think the one I received was Two Becks and the Blacklist Bats or something catchy like that. But it's just nice that they've spent that time to create that dynamic content. So it's just that personal touch for each subscriber. Their content is great. They curate articles from across the email community, which they know that we'll be interested in. So yeah, that's a great newsletter to subscribe to.
Rebecca Highfield, part-time goth and marketing manager at Action Rocket. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
The biggest challenge for an emergency manager is to get the person who makes a decision to do so rationally rather than whatever they see as their political advantage or instinctive reaction that may or may not be correct. So wrote John M. Barry about the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918. 100 years later, and a new emergency has swept the globe. I'm joined by strategy consultant Uri Baruchin to talk about how to do strategy in a crisis. Uri, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave.
First of all, can you tell us a bit about your work?
Yeah, I work as a creative strategist and a strategic thinking coach and mentor with both B2B and B2C brands, as well as creative agencies who are trying to improve the strategic thinking across the team. So, you know, strategic thinking doesn't stay just with a strategy team, but everyone is more strategic.
So what elements from Barry's study then on that epidemic in 1918 apply when we look at coronavirus and its impact on organizations in 2020?
Well, I mean, so the first things that stands out like painfully is how similar it all is. How, you know, some leaders act quickly and decisively and yet some try to pretend they are strong and hope somehow it will go away because they know that the tough measures needed would make them look bad. So, you know, there's a parade in Philadelphia that still goes forward and becomes this super spreader event. Yeah. And on the other end, in St. Louis, is focused mostly on the US, they are much more decisive and it fares much better. Or San Francisco is one of the first cities to just go into lockdown. And it's a very similar lockdown to ours with social distancing and masks. And that's 1918. And they are more decisive. And it's the same thing we know from today. You know, how early the lockdown happens and how well it is enforced. And some, you know, and in San Francisco, and the last time it was one of the first to act, and it wasn't as badly as New York, for example. Mm. And you read it and it's heartbreaking because early measures change death toll by enormous factors. And it just happened again and might happen again yet. And still, you know, I mean, trying to put on a brave face and then stick that face in the sand remains as moronic. So my biggest takeaway, and something Barry is still talking about today, is the importance of being honest with the people. He talks a lot about trust, how society is based on trust. And I think, you know, organizations are also based on trust. So where leaders were honest with the people and acted quickly and clearly, it saved lives. And where they didn't, not only there's a higher death toll, but you can see how society starts fraying and the tensions in society rise, and it takes years to recover from that, because you know you can't both make people feel like you didn't trust them and possibly lie to them and abandon them, and then later also expect them to willingly make sacrifices and give up their liberties and follow all the instructions, because they won't make that effort. If you lie to them, you basically said, hey, it's every person for themselves, and they'll behave that way. So in a similar way, you can think about, for example, organizations having to go through the painful exercise of cutting jobs. And some managers out there believe that grace under fire means pretending it all be okay. But lying isn't very graceful. So initially your team thinks, oh, okay, I believe them. I just have to do as I told and work hard and it'll be okay. And then a couple of weeks later, you do let people go, and they just feel betrayed. So you start having the kind of organization where people pretend to follow the leader and care about the company, but actually it's everyone for themselves. And it's all just stuck in survival mode and on both a personal and organizational level.
And the first reaction of many organizations to a crisis is that survival mode. Can you offer up any other characteristics as to what that looks like?
So this is personally one of the things I find most fascinating, because, you know, humans react to stress through a focused set of distinctive ways, quite famous, so, you know, fight, flight, freeze, fawn, those kind of things. And the interesting thing, of course, is that for societies to survive, you need all sorts of people that tend to react in different ways, right? Because if they are just taking the crisis face on, then, you know, a lot of the fighters can die, but in this, on the same level, you can't have people always running away from the crisis either. But the thing is that in survival mode, when stress is high, people tend to just default to their type and the feelings that come with it. So, you know, fighters feel a lot of anger and flighters feel fear and anxiety. And as long as you're just focused on immediate survival, you're kind of stuck. And the risk is that if there isn't enough resilience, you then become traumatized. And then post-traumatic people get triggered into that instinctive response very easily. So the interesting thing, I think, is that organizations do that in a similar way. If they get stuck in their survival mode, then you see those almost like immediate reflexive reactions, where, for example, organizations where everything is super critical and urgent and you're just trying to get through the day, or there's a strong control focus, or there's a conservation mentality and you just play it safe all the time, or there's just a general resistance to change, or the organization becomes very short-term and reactive. And over time, that can kind of calcify, and you get what I've nicknamed the post-traumatic organization, where everything gets very uncreative and rigid and reactive and brittle, and it's quite a toxic environment for people. So you can see all those as organizational stress responses that have their role, like, you know, sticking to our knitting, right? That's one of those sentences that gets said a lot in a crisis. It has a role, but on a more severe level, if it gets kind of like rigid, then it's a very toxic environment for people and businesses.
How do organizations typically try to plan for crises?
So the traditional risk management or crisis management approaches are kind of linear. They tend to first map the source of potential danger and then assess them and develop plans and put people in charge of those plans and train those people. I mean, that's all very important, but it's important for survival, and that's not enough. It works better when what you're doing is, say, saving your company from a fire or a security breach or organizational misdeeds, for example. And I think according to one model, there's like 8 types of crisis that you need to prepare to protect yourself from. But none of those cover something like COVID in full, because it's not enough to survive. We now need to rebuild the business that burned down. And with something like COVID, many organizations still months later have what's known as a smoldering crisis, where the crisis is still ongoing. Yes, we've survived. Everybody's working, you know, a lot of people are working from home. So things are slightly more stable, but the challenges continue coming in. So if we shift to the more modern turnaround approaches, and, you know, a shout out here to the Institute for Turnaround, they start the same like the traditional approach, but then they focus on continuity. So they talk about liquidity and supply chain resilience and stakeholder confidence and protecting your KPIs. And that's another step in the right direction. But again, that might not be enough. And in the case of COVID, we now know it's not enough to recover from the trauma to the business and the supply chain. You also need to now adapt to demand side changes. So now you need to adapt your operational model, including senior management and potentially your entire business model. And you need to start thinking about your long-term position in the market and what is your role really now. And you have to start to put a strategy in place. So, you know, there I've said it, the S word, because as long as you're not being truly strategic, you're in survival mode, and that may win you back some stability. But over the longer term, it actually undermines your ability to thrive, just like it does for people.
Can you tell us a bit more about the benefits of making space for strategy in crisis?
Right. So first, there's always time for strategy. And we've all been there where it feels like strategy is the first thing that gets thrown out the window. But, you know, one of the things that I've learned through years of collecting different strategic methods and paradigms is that the strategic thinking processes share a similar shape. And to choose an example, there's a famous US military strategy model where they teach fighter jet pilots to use a certain model of thinking while they're dogfighting. It's called the OODA model, and it stands for observe, orient, decide, and act. And it works with those feedback loops to each one of the stages, so you're adaptive. And it's very similar to a lot of strategic thinking models that we use in business, only we draw them out over weeks and sometimes months. It's the shape of a classic strategic process and feedback loops. And most of them are. So you could sometimes say to clients, you know, if a dogfighting pilot has time to do strategy in fractions of seconds in the air, you have time for it too. But somehow strategy gets, you know, bundled with luxuries and gets put on hold, if not thrown out the window completely in many cases. And the benefits are huge, the benefits to being strategic, because if I go back to that survival mode risk that I mentioned, being strategic doesn't just build resilience. You can think about it as resilience because, you know, strategists get a bad reputation sometimes for being naysayers and hypercritical and pessimists. But actually, you can't be a strategist without being optimist, without having a growth mindset. Because you have to think about solutions and you have to think about the future and you have to compare different futures and ask yourself how you get to positive outcomes. That's a very positive mindset. You know, you have to keep your emotions regulated. You shouldn't avoid the negative, but you shouldn't let them run wild. And if you fail or if you expect some failure, you see it as a form of useful feedback and you learn from it. all those, it's almost like the qualities of the strategic thinkers and people who are more strategic, those are all signs of psychological resilience, of actual well-being. So you can start by giving people some tools, which is what I often do in my work as a strategy mentor. I mean, everybody is naturally strategic and that instinct can be trained. And by creating within your company a shared thinking framework, people get this sense of unity together with this newfound sense of both purpose and resilience. And isn't that what we all need right now?
Absolutely. And what's more, in that piece, Uwe, I learned about a strategy for dogfighting that I'd never come across before. Uwe Bruchin, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Next up, Lior Franks shares a key lesson that he's taken on the journey to being CMO of Augusta Ventures. Lior, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you. I'm really good. And I'm fascinated to find out what exactly is Augusta Ventures.
Sure. Well, happy to talk about that. And thank you very much for the invitation. So Augusta is a legal services business. We focus on providing funding, money for legal disputes. In fact, we're the largest funder of litigation in the UK by volume of cases that we take on. We operate globally through our hubs in North America, Australia, and here in London. I mean, in case you're not familiar with what litigation finance is, perhaps I can provide a quick example of the kind of scenario in which we might help clients.
Sure.
Imagine for a second that you're the CEO of a fairly large business, let's say a 100 million turnover business, and all was going well with your business until this horrible pandemic struck a few months ago. And suddenly you have a variety of operational issues, not least your biggest customer has decided not to pay its £10 million bill. And for a £100 million business, suddenly losing £10 million in revenue is obviously a very significant cataclysm for you. And you've tried everything you can to try and persuade your customer to pay. You've negotiated, you've looked at payment terms, but fundamentally, they simply don't want to pay you. So you've really come to the end of your tether, and finally you go to your lawyers and you say to the lawyers, here's the situation, here's the loss I've suffered. And the lawyers look at the case and say, look, you have a very strong case. The legal merits are strong. Your chance of recovery are very high. You will get back the £10 million if you decide to take legal action, which is great news for you. At which point the lawyers say, but I need £2 million from you to cover the legal costs. And I need that money up front in escrow because of your financial situation. I want to be sure it's there before I go forward. The problem is you've been having some trouble because of the pandemic. You've lost £10 million in revenue. You simply don't have £2 million in your back pocket, in the bank, behind the sofa or wherever to cover these costs. Now, unfortunately, a lot of businesses find themselves in that situation and they might end up walking away from meritorious legal actions because they don't have that money. That's where a litigation funder can come in, and a law firm will say, let me introduce you to the funder, and the funder will step in and basically pay all of those bills. They'll pay the £2 million of legal costs, and they'll offer finance for other associated costs, whether it's accounting fees or expert witness fees. And the particularly unusual way in which that finance is provided is it's on a non-recourse basis. What that means is if you lose the case, you don't owe any money to the funder. So there's no risk to you whatsoever in taking that finance. There's no interest to pay. There's effectively no downside if you lose the case. If you win the case, which hopefully you will, the funder obviously needs to recover its investment and its profit, but they recover that from your supplier, the people who owe you money. Okay. So really, this is a risk transfer mechanism. You don't have to put cash up front, and it allows people to take forward strong legal cases, particularly now in difficult situations where they simply don't have the money.
Okay, that's very clearly explained. Thank you. And your CMO there. So I wonder if you can tell us what's made you the brilliant B2B marketer that you are today.
Thank you, Dave. Well, that's very kind of you to describe me in that way.
You just described your company so eloquently. How could I not follow it up with that?
Well, I'll take the compliment. And perhaps I'll talk a little bit about my background and the experiences that I've had that have got me to the position I am in today and have developed my skill set. Obviously, most of my experiences in B2B marketing, particularly in services, especially in professional services. And for me, one of the most important skills of a marketeer in that field is about being the voice of the customer. Mm. It's about understanding what's going on in the market and bringing intelligence into the firm to help make decisions around marketing, but also around strategy and other matters. And the way in which I think been lucky to be able to do that is through some of the experiences I've had. And there are three particular things I wanted to touch on, which I think are to some degree replicable for others. The first is around actually getting experience of the clients themselves. And I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in a second. Secondly, is having some courses, qualifications, some training behind yourself to give you the basic core skills to be able to do the job at hand. And thirdly, and I think this is incredibly important, ensuring connection with stakeholders. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment, if I may. On the experience point, I mean, if I briefly talk about my background, at the beginning of my career, I was a journalist editing a professional services industry magazine, which gave me a lot of contact with both the industry players and the clients, getting an understanding about what each side of that equation cared about. I then went to business school and moved into fee earning consulting roles, originally at Arthur Andersen and Ernst & Young, where I qualified. And a lot of my time in those roles was out on client sites, working hand in hand with clients, listening to their issues, understanding what they needed from us, what they liked and what they didn't like. And then I spent a year or so as chief of staff to the CEO of a FTSE 100 company. And whilst I was primarily there to write speeches and take notes and help with communications, there were a number of times when we had to appoint professional advisors, and listening to the discussions, the machinations, the points of difference between the firms was incredibly useful for me in my later marketing director roles in forming strategy, because I think I had an insight into what it is that clients wanted. And I mean, that's probably more than enough about my background, but the point I wanted to make is I've been fortunate in having a number of experiences where I've been able to touch clients, either as a journalist or as a client serving professional or as someone in a large company listening to decisions being made. And what I've always said to my teams and the people that I work with is find opportunities to get that insight yourself. And that doesn't mean go and spend 3 years working as chief of staff of a company or anything like that. But what it does mean is within the confines of your role, find opportunities. Is that a secondment? Is it sitting with a client-serving team as they deliver a piece of work? Is it simply listening in to a pitch? Obviously, it would have been in person a few months ago. Now it's all virtual. Whatever you can do to reach out and touch clients, I think, is incredibly important. And you can do this regardless of your level. You know, at the early part of my career, I was taking notes and carrying bags. And later in my career, I'm delivering the presentation. So wherever you are, hierarchically, there's an opportunity to do that. So that's the first takeaway. Sorry, go ahead.
I'll just follow up on that. So there are a lot of marketers who I know would kind of push back at this point and say, actually, look, they don't have that opportunity. They're kind of barred from access to the client. And you kind of talked a little bit about the number of ways in which it might be possible to be able to get an in. Can you give some advice to those marketers that have just been told, no, stay out of the meetings with the client?
Yes, I'll try to. And that's obviously an unfortunate position to be in. But I can imagine in some situations, either for structural or political reasons, that might happen. I mean, if you can't persuade people to take you along or at least allow you to listen in, there are other ways in which you can learn. Industry publications, reading the magazines, listening to the podcasts that your target client interact with. I mean, I've spent the last 6 or 7 years focused on the legal market as our client base. I read all of the mainstream legal magazines, The Lawyer, Legal Week. I try to go to their conferences. In fact, I'm speaking at an International Bar Association conference next week. If you can't physically get out and see clients in terms of pitches and delivery, go to where they hang out, read what they read and listen to what they listen to. And hopefully you can do that regardless of what the management above you say about your interaction with clients on a daily basis.
Thank you. And then, sorry, your second tip was about qualifications.
Yes, absolutely. So look, I think if you're working in a professional environment, having some basis to your vocation is important. And I mean, I'm lucky in that I have several professional qualifications behind me. of two types, and I'll explain that very briefly. I did a business school master's at the beginning of my career, and then I did a financial qualification, and both of those I think were helpful in terms of getting me started. And I've always encouraged my teams and my colleagues to get the relevant technical skills that they need, whether it's CIM or some other form of marketing qualification. And that's important, I think, for two reasons. It's important to ensure you know what you're talking about. I mean, that might sound obvious, but you don't know what you don't know. And until you've taken a formal qualification, your eyes can't be open to everything that's out there. But it's incredibly important, I think, for credibility, especially in professional services where you're working with professionally qualified people, where the effective essence of what they deliver is professional skill. If you have that professional background, qualifications of your own, I think it increases your kudos. But the second point I'd make is have an insight into the issues that affect clients. And I know this is something that not everyone can do, but in three of my roles, I've actually put my own money and time into taking qualifications related to the industry I'm in. So I spent some time in insurance. I did some insurance exams, not because it was necessary for my job, but because I wanted to make sure I understood the market. I mentioned I spent some time in a listed company. I did an investor relations qualification. It wasn't core to my role, but ultimately we were a listed company. I wanted to be sure that I understood the market. So I think there's a lesson there for people. Understand the market you're in. You can obviously read magazines, you can listen to podcasts, but if you can do a qualification, if you have the time, the effort, the money to do that, it gives you a great basis. And I have personally been in situations with senior partners where I'm the most knowledgeable in the room about a particular client industry because of those qualifications. And that's been incredibly useful on several occasions.
That's great advice. I've heard the marketing qualification advice before, but actually the advice that you actually start taking the qualifications to suit the profession that you're in is a great one in terms of customer understanding.
I think it's an ideal thing for people to do, but it may not be practical in every situation. Mm-hmm. But today, given lockdown, given the fact we're all used to doing everything virtually, remotely, you know, this is a perfect example. I'm sure we would have been doing this in person in a room.
In a studio.
Yeah, exactly. There are qualifications, short courses you can do online. They don't have to be very expensive courses. You know, I was fortunate when you and I worked together at EY years ago, Dave. I was given money to go to London Business School for a week-long course. I was financed to go to Cranfield to do the Marketing Director's course for a week, which was wonderful. But, you know, they cost £10,000 a time. You can do really good quality stuff for tens, if not hundreds of pounds virtually online today without your employer support after work, whether it's the industry you're serving or additional technical disciplines. If you've got the time and you're saving time and effort on not traveling, and you don't have other issues in your life to complicate things, it's an ideal opportunity to get those skills, in my view.
That's great. So remind us of your third tip.
So my third point was about connection with a number of different audiences that I think we all have to be mindful of. The first is the market. I've touched on it. I think reading industry publications, making sure you know what's going on, is of paramount importance. And I've been saddened, frankly, in several of my director roles when I've arrived in those firms to find that my colleagues haven't been up to speed with the markets they're in. And I've really very much encouraged people to have that connection to the market by reading and listening and learning. But the second point of connection that I'd very much like to talk about is to your internal stakeholders. And this is obvious, I'm sure everyone thinks about it, but in professional services particularly, understanding clients and understanding the partners who are serving those clients is fundamentally important. The challenge is sometimes you're remote from those partners that I'm talking about. Obviously, lockdown makes it harder, but I've always encouraged my people to physically sit with the business they're serving where possible. And look, you know, in many firms, partners are in offices. You can't physically, you know, encroach in their office and go and sit on the corner of their desk, but you can try and find a desk outside. Or you can sit in the area that the team is in, just listening to the banter of those teams, bumping into them at the water cooler, incredibly important. The nuggets you pick up from general day-to-day conversation are important, but also your relationship, building your relationship by being physically present, difficult obviously right now, but it makes the teams you're serving feel that you're one of them as opposed to someone from some central function in a remote location in Beckett House, which is a joke David and I might recall from many years ago. So being proximate to your stakeholders, being in touch with them, having a connection with them, as well as being connected to the market, incredibly important. And these aren't things that cost a lot of time or money. You just have to make the effort where you can.
Leo Frank, CMO of Augusta Ventures, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. Good to speak to you.
There's some great B2B marketing out there, and I'm joined now by Lisa Daniels, the head of marketing at BT Enterprise, to look at some of it. Lisa, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So there's some really good B2B marketing in the marketplace. What's caught your eye?
So one of the brands I've admired most over the past sort of 12 months or so is the introduction of Slack to big, you know, to big organizations. You know, they've been pretty bold in going up against the likes of Skype and Teams and Zoom and all the platforms that we already know about. And I think their success has been pretty phenomenal. You know, they really tell a story. And, you know, clearly their communication style is baked on their audience insight. I think one of the most interesting things about the rise of these sort of up and coming brands, technology-led brands, is that they're using kind of B2C tactics to acquire B2B users. So using platforms like out of home, you know, really snappy messaging that's got personality and humor. And I think that's something that we can all think about, you know, for our businesses when we're trying to create cut through. I think, you know, Slack has taken a sort of more fun, playful, creative brand image and not a stuffy corporate generic image, which I think has really helped it to stand out from the crowd, but also resonate well with the younger generation of business decision makers.
So there's a lot of good points there. The importance of story, the importance of insight, the importance of perhaps stealing from the best tactics that you're seeing elsewhere. What have you learned from the Slack approach that you're going to take away and apply to future work at BT?
So I think the first one is almost a reminder, really, of being, you know, truly customer first, single-minded in your messaging, investing in your research and really understanding the psychology behind the mindsets and the motivations of your customers. I think, you know, when you're working in a much larger organization, it's easy to lose sight of actually the audience that you're talking to and how they're wired up. I think the second thing, which I think a lot of B2B marketing is guilty of, is not creating an emotional connection in your communication. You know, in B2C, it's the primary thing is, does it hit an emotional, does it create an emotional reaction? And in B2B, it feels like it's quite the opposite conversation. And arguably, you know, you creating a business decision is going to affect change across your whole organization or your customers or your sales trading is actually about as emotional as it can get. So I think that just making sure that you're thinking about the human being at the end of your communication. I think the second thing is about the weighing up the balance between performance-led marketing and lead generation and brand building. I think it's really important to get your sort of sales funnel and your marketing, your acquisition marketing strategy nailed before you do too much in the brand space, because you need to be able to take customers through that journey. But I think what they've managed to do quite well is actually get those two areas in place so that, you know, they've really thought it all the way through. And maybe again, because they will inevitably be a smaller marketing machine, I suppose, they're less set on the breakout of different channels. So they probably don't have like a campaign team over here and then a base team, you know, to the right somewhere. They're probably doing the end-to-end thing, which I think really comes through and it's really worked in their success.
Lisa Daniels, Head of Marketing at BT Enterprise. Thank you very much. And that's it. That's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Rebecca Highfield, Uri Baruchin, Leo Franks and Lisa Daniels. And thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andrew Gratian and Josh Bench. Thanks too to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can and email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's more where this came from. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community run by B2B marketers for B2B marketers. And you can check out our other webinars, podcasts, events, mentoring, blogs, newsletters, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. Just go to businessmarketingclub.org.uk. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.